it's Karen Webster, and welcome to Data Drivers, our weekly show where we tell a story about a topic in payments using only three data points. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Daniel Kornitzer, the Executive Vice President and Chief Product Officer at Paysafe. Daniel, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the topic today is certainly a big topic. We're going to try to narrow it down just a bit. It's the changing payments landscape, but the filter that we'll be using today to talk about it is the consumer's perspective. So how consumers are adapting and adopting to what is clearly a very digital mobile payments environment. And the data points are taken from a study that Paysafe conducted, 3,000 or so consumers throughout the UK, Canada, and the United States, and some very interesting findings as a result. So Daniel, if you're set, I'll dive in with the first data point. You ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. So data point number one, 85%. This is perhaps not surprising, but it's the percentage of 18 to 34-year-olds who say they will use a mobile wallet more than they use it today over the next 2 years. And so I'm curious to get your perspective on that overall, but if you also detect any differences throughout the geographies that you studied and surveyed as a part of this work.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting data point. I believe that we're at the confluence of changes prompted by the changes in consumer behavior, as well as, you know, the changing landscape in technology and other changes like the regulatory changes. When it comes to the consumer, looking at millennials, 18 to 34-year-olds, It doesn't surprise me at all to see that 85% would see themselves using more mobile wallets. Let's remember that these, you know, youngsters have been trained by the Ubers of the world in terms of, you know, signing up for services, you know, walking out of a car without having to pay or worry about tips and things of that nature. There is also the tremendous influence of contactless. And if you look at the data, that seems to be perhaps even more pointing to a faster adoption in places like the UK or Canada, where the proliferation of NFC and the use of contactless is quite you know, ubiquitous. So when you look at mobile wallets, you can also look at them as a natural extension of contactless, you know, credit card transactions. So in one case, you tap a card, in another you tap a phone, but it is a natural extension, and it's basically adding, you know, basically biometric authentication to the process, which has two benefits. One is that the amounts are no longer limited by the contactless thresholds, and it also has the side benefit of allaying fears of fraud by the consumers. So I'm not surprised at all to see that in the, especially in the younger generation.
It's interesting that you bring up the contactless point, because I do think it's different in different parts of the world. And certainly here in the U.S., mobile wallets for use in-store have been very slow to adopt. But I'm not sure that it's had a lot to do necessarily with the lack of access to contactless. I think, you know, perhaps introduced at a point in time where consumers wanted more than just a different form factor to use to check out in a store. Do you think that there are other forces that may influence mobile wallet usage and adoption more that perhaps don't necessarily align to contactless technology?
Well, obviously, there is never a single element. You know, it's always a confluence of factors, but when I look at things through the eyes of a consumer, because I'm a technologist at heart, but I'm also a consumer. So in our lovely Montreal weather, when it's winter and it's, you know, minus 30 and I'm trying to gas up, the last thing I want to do is to, you know, take my glove out, insert the card, wait, type a PIN, freeze my fingers. I want to tap my card, my phone. I don't really care about form factor, whether it's PayPass, PayWave, you know, Apple Pay, Android Pay or Samsung Pay. It doesn't really matter to me. The use case is convenience, speed, and that's why I see mobile wallets as sort of a natural extension of contactless. I'm not saying that every use case would be the same, but in that particular example, all I want is not to have to freeze my fingers, and anything would do.
So if this 85% statistic is, in fact, the reality, so these 18 to 34-year-olds make good on their declaration that they will use mobile wallets more, how does that affect merchants? How should merchants be thinking about that potential as they think about the experience in store?
Well, in general, I think that the research shows that it's essential that businesses take a diversified approach on how they accept and process payments to accommodate both the traditional and the emerging payment technologies. So in other words, no merchant should be required to have a crystal ball as to what methods are going to carry the day, and to some extent, not even a payment processing company, because at the end, our technology should be agnostic. So we should present all the methods that are out there and let the consumers and merchants essentially let the market decide, you know, what becomes more, you know, proliferates more than others. And I think the same applies to merchants. Offer the choice.
So how do you then think about advising merchants on those choices? Because I agree with you that merchants will always follow what consumers want to do, but do merchants need proof first before making those investments, or how do they then decide which set of options to choose? Because there are lots and lots and lots of them that that merchants could choose from today.
Well, I'm sure that they could use metrics or KPIs as to which methods provide the highest degree of uplift. But when you think of an APM or another payment method, I think that I would look upon it as a door to my store. So the more methods I offer, the more I'm going to cater to the needs of consumers. The rest, I guess, the market will decide. But you can look at how, you know, frequently people use that payment method, and then decide, you know, if I add this one, I could increase my sales by 3%, maybe the other one by 5%, and go by, decreasing order of value, and you know, get the ones that have the highest potential first.
So that's a great segue to data point number two, as we're talking about options and payment methods. So data point number two is 25%, and that is the percentage of Canadians, millennials between 18 and 34, who say they are cash free. How do you react to that?
Yeah, another interesting data point. Just as an aside, I think that it's important to note that cash free doesn't necessarily mean cashless. In other words, consumers seem to be moving away from cold hard cash, but not necessarily from alternate forms such as cash vouchers, including our own PaySafe card product. And you know, oftentimes when we look at data from different geographies, I mean, and we try to find differences and any you know, different cultures or I think that, and you've pointed that from the get-go, that the biggest difference, and we can probably later on delve into some of the details. I find that if you look at 18-25 or even 18-34 versus 65 plus, that is probably the biggest difference in terms of usage and attitudes. And as people, I guess, use less, you know, hard cash. I do believe they still carry cash in their pockets. The example, you know, we were discussing just before the call is the fact that when you have multiple credit cards, you know in which order you prefer to use them, but you still like the fact to have you know, an alternate credit card, just in case the first one doesn't go through for whatever reason, you want to have option B and option C. So it's good to know that you have cash. I still remember the time where I was in London in a taxi, and for some reason his machine didn't work. So I had to ask him to stop at an ATM for me to withdraw cash to pay the cab. So all that to say, it's good to have cash as a backup mechanism, but over time with the abundance of digital payment methods from credit card to debit card to, you know, mobile wallets, there is a decrease in the use of cash.
Daniel, I think you fell for the oldest taxi trick in the book. The old, my machine is broken, so I need to take cash. But you were a good sport. You went to an ATM and got the money. But your point's well taken. People still carry cash, but they're not using as much of it. So, you know, the money you take out of an ATM lasts longer than it did even a couple of years ago. Is there a cultural aspect to this? I mean, there are certainly certain you know, demographics and certain types of individuals who like cash because it is tangible and it helps them budget and they physically know how much money they have left to spend. Does that have a particular bearing on how cash thrives and survives across the markets that you looked at?
Well, some of it is cultural, no doubt of it, but look at India, you know, a society that was very much cash driven after demonetization, you know, the use of wallets, QR codes and stuff like that is just incredible. I think I was there in February and, you know, people were paying, you know, tolls, the equivalent of 20 cent tolls by basically reading the QR code and pushing funds to the toll. I think I saw a beggar with a QR code on his hat. So just to give you an example you know, change is happening. That being said, yes, people like the fact that cash is tangible, that it's always a backup mechanism that doesn't depend on any connection or any, you know, lying cab driver that may tell you that the machine is broken. So there is something to it, but I think that overall there is a decrease in the use, no question about it.
It's interesting, and then we'll move on to the third data point. I was out to dinner on Friday night, and in the area of Boston that is has a high concentration of really scrumptious Italian restaurants, and there's this very famous bakery called Mike's Pastry, and they have the most delicious homemade desserts, cannolis, and so forth. And they have a big sign: "We only accept cash." And so people go to the ATM and they stock up, and they go into Mike's Pastry and they buy their cannolis and wedding cookies and really delicious things. But you know, some merchants that, I mean, this shop's been around for probably seven decades, so it's the old habits die hard, I guess, for everyone.
And they probably can afford to, you know, they have a name, yeah, a reputation, people come all over, so they have more kind of bargaining power. If it's a brand new store that no one knows, yeah, you probably don't, yeah, want to be the guy that turns consumers down because they can't pay with another method. I would advise against that. It's probably
totally
the exception that confirms the rule.
Totally agree. So let's go to the third data point, which I think is really interesting, and this is this has to do with people in your survey who say they've abandoned a shopping cart online in the last month, so in the last 30 days, and that data point is 67%. I mean, that is shocking. Sometimes that's even higher, but why is that a phenomenon, and why doesn't it seem to be getting better?
Actually, I looked at the data on shopping cart abandonment in quite a bit of detail. First of all, I think shopping carts are being used in more use cases. You know, people, especially millennials, are often at a store, and while they're, you know, checking the prices at another, either online or at another store. So you've got all these kind of live shopping where you're pretty much comparing or even reading barcodes and finding out who sells it at a lower price. So the power that's been given to the consumer is just incredible. And millennials have realized that it's empowered their process and given them tools to achieve, you know, better prices more information, better prices for everything they acquire. Think of the situation of how a person would have done any sort of transaction, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I don't know, an AC that breaks, you know, you would have probably gone to the white pages or yellow pages, found the distributor, and then called them, and they would have sent the local rep to fix your machine. Now you go online, you check the vendors, you know which one has a better consumer ratings. You know, by the time you get to the repairman that you handpick based on reviews and all kinds of things, you are super knowledgeable. You know exactly what you want. You know the comparisons, the trade-offs. So the consumers are much more educated. They're tech savvy. They're informed, and it really puts the consumer in the driver's seat. Now, when it comes to shopping kind of abandonment, it's part of the process of weighing options. If I look at the criteria, and some of that is also confirmed by similar research by other research houses in terms of the reasons for abandonment. But what I found most interesting, if you don't mind, I'd like to just delve into some of the data, because I also love data. You know, it's taken away the discussing over opinions, and you know, having data I think solves the problem. It reminds me of Jim Barksdale's famous quote, you know, if we have data, let's look at it. You know, if all we have is opinions, let's take mine or let's go with mine. So and that's the reality. You know, it's why speculate when we can get to the data. So some of the reasons for shopping kind of abandonment in order of decreasing importance: hidden transaction fees and delivery charges, decide to shop around further, so you know, people being undecided, product not in stock, delivery will take too long, inconvenient delivery times. So for the most part, the first three, the data seems to be quite consistent across age groups, which, by the way, the biggest clash or gap is between age groups in my view. Now, if I look at inconvenient delivery times, 30% of the 18-25, you know, cite that as a major factor, whereas only 9% of the 65+. So delivery times are, you know, the youngsters are much more sensitive to those than the people in the 65+ age. Big difference. Another area of the gap would be a lack of payment options. 26% of the 18-25 cite that as a major factor, only 11% of the 65+. And the third and last one would be website is not easy to use on mobile. 16% of the 18-25, only 5% of the 65+. So these would be three areas where there is a major gap in perception between the millennials and the 65+. And I find that quite interesting. The same type of data is reflected when you look at shopping behavior, where many of the millennials will cite things related to mobile ordering, whereas the older people, I guess, use less mobiles to order, so it's not an issue that races to their top list of concerns.
Interesting on the lack of payment options. Did you dig into that? Is it that there weren't digital wallets available, or you know, direct to bank account, or did you get specifics on on what people felt were lacking?
No, I don't have specifics because that's probably the lowest level of granularity that we have. But I'm going to speculate that the younger population tends to be at the sort of the leading edge of, you know, using different methods and stuff. And you know, some of the methods that they may want to try may even go up to like cryptocurrency. And so, whereas, you know, 65 plus, they're probably going to be much more standard in their choice of methods. You know, like if you're in Canada, probably credit cards and things of that nature, Interac. So I'm not surprised at all to see the young consumers be more pushing the limits of payment methods, as they're often the early adopters of these technologies.
If I think about some of the things that you could influence when you're talking with merchants to solve this problem, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a function of maybe retargeting or marketing or something that converts the browsers to buyers, and you can do that, you know, to the best of your ability. I thought the interesting one was the first one were hidden fees, because that really does get you. You know, I think we've all experienced the fact that you put something in your shopping cart and then, you know, all of a sudden you see delivery fees and taxes and, depending upon where you're buying from, other fees, and it pushes people out of their comfort zone for wanting to buy. How do merchants fix that problem?
Well, there is no question, especially for small ticket items, if you find that the delivery fee, especially if you want it, you know, overnight or very quickly, oftentimes could be, you know, 40-50% of the price of the item. So I'm not surprised at all that once, you know, you see a $25 item, but once you want to get it, you know, overnight plus the taxes and any other fees, that $25 transaction becomes $45. That's a big turnoff as a consumer.
Right.
So it doesn't surprise me. I mean, there is a limit to how low, I guess, merchants can go in terms of the cost of shipping. In the States, oftentimes they'll give you free shipping. Somehow it has to be paid for. I mean, so it's just not added on. They have to factor into their business model. And, you know, I think Amazon has an edge given their volume, that their cost of shipping is on average something like $5, whereas the average merchant probably pays $1 or $2 more because they don't have the same, you know, enormous volumes. But that cost is either charged as an extra or somehow built in to the prices. This data seems to indicate that maybe they're better off adding a percentage for delivery and providing free delivery, I mean, with minimum transaction amounts. But that seems to be a good way to allay those concerns and not have as much of a drop-off in terms of checkout orders.
What did you hear from consumers with respect to concerns over data security and data privacy over using new payment methods? Were there differences in millennials versus older consumers who responded to the survey questions?
Let me pull that data so I don't misquote. I think security, I'm just trying to find out if there is a big gap in terms of the security data. I do remember the figure of 67% of people surveyed, around 60% of people said security was a main barrier for faster adoption of contactless payments. And I'm not surprised. I can't find the data by age for that figure, but it doesn't surprise me to see a certain amount of concern, because as much as consumers are thrilled with the convenience of contactless, they can't help but think what would happen if they were to lose or if someone stole their credit card and started, you know, tapping it. to do fraudulent purchases everywhere. It's a valid concern, although many consumers don't realize that issuers would prompt for PIN if they detect an unusual pattern of contactless transactions, so say 3 or 4 within a very short time span. So there are some protections, but consumers see it being so easy, you know, someone just takes my card and goes around and can be spending all day. So it's a valid concern. And one of the reasons why I said at the very beginning that I see mobile wallets as the natural evolution of contactless is that that is exactly the answer. Because once you add biometry, well, someone can take my phone, but they're not going to have my fingers, so they're not going to be able to start tapping my phone and paying. So it's kind of contactless with the added biometry. And by the way, as a consumer, I wouldn't really, you know, care much for the form factor. So if tomorrow there is a Visa or MasterCard or Amex card that comes with a finger, you know, fingerprint detector on the card, that would actually do the same, because it would combine biometry with the convenience of contactless, and that would also probably allow the elimination of limits. So it would be super convenient for it. So whether it's mobile wallets or cards with biometry in it, I think that's the type of answer that addresses two concerns: the security fear and the limitations that issuers are obliged to put to ensure that we don't encounter fraud.
So Daniel, we have just a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you, so as a merchant looking at this data on the, you know, the next generation of shopper and their expectations and also their usage patterns, what should they take away from this, and how do they need to be ready to accommodate these preferences?
Well, I think that merchants need to do their best to offer as many alternatives and payment methods to cater to the evolving needs of their consumer base. They need to work with companies, you know, payment processors, issuers, acquirers that understand, you know, how to curtail risk. That can help them in terms of protecting their interest as well as those of the consumers. You know, keep on taking advantage of the newer technologies and servicing consumers better. There's also the whole area of data analytics and understanding consumer behavior. I think the insights that you can gain through those type of tools is another great tool to better serve your customer base and hopefully go to the point where we can deliver, you know, mass customization, cater to the needs of consumers. It's kind of like recreating the good old days where the mom and pa shop owner knew their customers personally and knew their tastes and what they like, whether you're a chef and knew exactly the type of dish that someone, you know, loves, or if you're the manager of or the owner of a clothing store and you knew the type of shirts that a certain customer wanted. That type of personalization and making customers feel like $1 million is something that technology can recreate in today's world. So that would be another, you know, so payment methods, use of technology to, you know, give more options, you know, good solid risk management and clever use of big data analytics to provide customization to the consumers and provide an experience that's second to none.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's using technology and data to preserve optionality. I think that's really the takeaway. And I know that there's a version 2 of this study that does examine from the merchant perspective what they're doing and how prepared they might be to respond to these changing preferences. We look forward to digging in to that with you at a later time. Daniel, thanks very much for taking your time today and sharing your insights.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a very good day and a good rest of the week. Thank you.